Russ Baker is the author of Family of Secrets, which chronicles the last 50 years, the Bush family and American history, and how they're all intertwined. He also has a great website, which I just discovered. It's whowhatwhy.com. Russ, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So there's so much to talk about. Let me introduce you to our audience, because you are a graduate of the Columbia Journalism School. There are two journalism schools in this country, University of Missouri and Columbia Journalism School, and maybe Ben Beckdickian's place up at Berkeley.
And Northwestern.
And Northwestern.
And I mean, listen, there are plenty of journalism schools.
And you've taught at the Columbia Journalism School.
I did years ago as an adjunct, yeah.
And you went to Serbia a couple of years ago to teach.
Almost a decade. It was 2002 to 2004 I was there.
You were in Serbia teaching a fledgling democracy how to have a vibrant, active fourth estate?
Yeah, believe it or not, I was actually paid by the U.S. government to go teach those people how to investigate their own government. Very interestingly, they don't want to pay me to do that here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the fourth estate, right?
Yeah.
And I was told the fourth estate was actually government agencies and that journalism was truly the fifth estate.
You know, it turns out there is no correct answer to that, that these estate notions are all a little bit vague and debated. So
okay.
Whatever it is, it's not one of the main principal estates.
Right.
It's down the pecking order.
Okay. So you are a real journalist. You've written for Vanity Fair. You've written for the New York Times, Esquire, Newsday. What you're doing on this show, I have no idea. No, I'm honored to have you on. And I'm reading your book. I haven't finished it. You talk a lot about the CIA in the book and George Herbert Walker Bush being in Dallas around the time that President Kennedy was assassinated. And you talk about the CIA. And I want to get to the stuff in the book, but let's talk about Condoleezza Rice speaking at the Republican convention. This is a woman who was our national security advisor when the towers came down. She was supposed to keep us safe. As I've said in my nightclub act, if she was very eloquent in her speech. If she could read intelligence memos as well as she read that speech, the Twin Towers would still be standing. She invaded the wrong country. She has the blood of, I think, Lancet, the medical magazine out of England, says 2 million Iraqis died because of this invasion. How does she dare to show her face at the Republican convention, a convention where Jeb Bush says that Obama has to stop blaming his brother for the problems of the United States? Why is Condoleezza Rice allowed to continue?
I don't know, but I have to say that I attribute both my professional success, such as it is, and my mental well-being to the fact that I pay very, very little attention to political conventions. My sense is that those things are principally distractions. They're enjoyable distractions. I certainly know why comedians like to pay attention to them, because they're just great material. But the percentage of scheduled events that fill up our bandwidth and leave us so little time to study the underlying mechanisms that cause these kinds of things to recur are sort of more my bag. So I can talk about conventions, I can watch them a little bit, but people like her, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, even Dick Cheney, to me, they are mere apparatchiks. They are people who gladly are foisted into the limelight to take the heat and be very well compensated for it, while others remain very much in the background. And I think ultimately sadly much more important in shaping the litany of things that we see, like perpetual war, the growing imbalance between rich and poor, that kind of stuff, which is always going on. We tend to focus on those, or a Sarah Palin, for example. And that's deliberate, that those people are put out there, because as long as we don't understand how and why these things perpetuate, or why, for example, one subject that interests me greatly is the where Obama is such a disappointment, and the ways in which he's kind of similar to Romney, that those are the things that really interest me. What are the structural impediments to a real democracy in this country? That's what Family of Secrets is about. I go back and I dig for decades, really, trying to understand the trajectory of this country and why particular people come into power and do the things they do. I do not believe that presidents are these singular figures upon the stage of history.
The great man theory.
Right. I don't buy that. I think these people are actors, principally. They are auditioned for their role, and as long as they play the role correctly, the Louis B. Mayers of the world allow them to keep their role. And right. That's really, you know, Family of Secrets, as you've seen, I mean, it's a chronicling of a series of what are really tantamount to coups in this country by the same people who actually are behind coups in other countries, doing the same thing here, albeit doing it in a much more sophisticated and careful way, but kind of moving in and out people when they do and do not play ball. And this is staggering to me, to do that kind of research and discover that all of these, you know, Jimmy Carter. Why did Jimmy Carter have one term? Why did Gerald Ford start as a purported moderate and then lurch to the right? Most people don't even remember that. The Halloween massacre, when all the detente people were thrown out and he brought in people by the names of Cheney, Rumsfeld, and George H.W. Bush. We don't look at those things. We don't study those. The media doesn't cover them. Even the political scientists barely pay attention to these internal maneuverings that change the direction of this country, really, and of history.
So there's a lot to talk about. And I guess you and I are coming from two separate directions. I believe in ad hominem attacks. You complain about the People magazine approach to journalism. If you come from Hollywood, it's always about the human being, that a story, you have to show the humanity, that we need to see who Romney is. And through the prism of Romney, we can understand the future of the Republican Party. And you dig down deep and you see Bain and you see the way he treated his dog. And you get a glimpse of what kind of president he's going to be, because we know that he put his dog on the roof of his car on a trip to Canada. You say that's not a great indice of what we're going to get from him.
It's not, because, listen, I know a lot of liberals, and they are no great shakes. You know, they treat other people like dogs. I mean, if we were to be reasonably objective about it, I know many conservative and even right-wing people who are the most gracious individually, and if you're in trouble, they will help you out. And I speak as somebody who's not from that sector at all, but I do see that liberals are really a mirror of conservatives, that they have all the same faults and defects, but things are selectively taken out of context. I mean, if you think that Mitt Romney is necessarily much less pleasant than, say, John Kerry one-on-one, you're wrong, you know? So right. I just don't care about that stuff personally, although when I go to, you know, the comedy store or something, I love to hear this stuff. So it's not that I don't care about that. It's not that I don't care what Romney's personality is like. It's just that I don't think Romney, he's just a guy, you know, it could be you, it could be me, anybody.
Is Bain Capital important? Is it important to look into Bain, or is it there's something even bigger than Bain?
Yeah, much bigger. In other words, Bain is just part of the system. Recently, I was on Martha's Vineyard. I was having a drink somewhere and started chatting with a guy. He asked me what I did. I told him. He said, very interesting. It turned out he's the general counsel for one of America's largest banks, and I mean largest. And we began talking. I showed him our website, whowhatwhy.com. He said, this is fascinating. I love what you're doing. I said, really? He said, yeah, you know, I'm trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, because I see the harm that we cause. And we started talking about it. He said, you know, the people that are vilified, though, like my boss, the people who run these banks, a lot of them individually you could have brunch with, you know, at the deli, and they're perfectly nice people who seem quite reasonable and even somewhat progressive. It's not so much any particular individual. It's the whole system. Mm-hmm. And what bothers me is that we're part of the system. I use the, you know, you talk about Hollywood. I love those movies. I think you guys in Hollywood do such an important job of raising people's awareness of bigger issues. Like, for example, I love The Matrix, because I use that analogy now that we're all sort of hooked up to The Matrix. We're all constantly bombarded with disinformation and propaganda and distractions and all of this stuff. And we don't see that the reason our lives in this country are so comfortable compared to still most people on Earth is because of a system of which we are part. And so we like to think we're not. But I mean, look at somewhere like L.A. How many people who support the Democratic Party are lawyers with big firms? I mean, who are their clients? It's the same people we're complaining about. And so I'm reticent to
Eric Holder, Covington. He comes from a law firm that defends Goldman Sachs.
Sure. But again, most of the firms do. The firms, you know, around the country, that's where the business is.
So are you looking for a grand unified theory about what moves this country? Because if you are, I might disagree with you. I don't want to get into an argument.
I don't know that there is a grand unified theory, but I'm trying to understand more about motivations and patterns, and I'm trying to understand more about why things happen. So, for example, the mere fact Americans don't understand how practically anything happened. We don't agree about who killed Kennedy. We don't agree about 9/11. We don't agree about why we were in Iraq. As I document in Family of Secrets, there's a whole other explanation of George W. Bush's personal reason for going into Iraq. Now, that sounds sort of amazing, but since then, General Wesley Clark has come out to reveal what he knew about that. And when you put all these pieces together, what you realize, for example, is that there were a whole bunch of people who went into Iraq for reasons other than they told us. They themselves didn't necessarily have the same principal motivation. One had one reason, one had another reason, and so on, but they all agreed, let's do this. And then, of course, the PR people come in, and then it's how do you convince the American people to do it? You can't say to them, look, we're going in because it's going to boost my ratings. We're going to go in because my friends can make a mint on the oil there. You can't say that. And so Americans are always told that everything is being done with the loftiest of purposes. Obama's exactly the same. They always tell you what makes you feel good about yourself and about your country. And it is this kind of massive delusion that I'm most interested in. And I'll tell you something. My role is to make people uncomfortable. And I'm okay with that. You know, you're a comedian. Your role is to make people uncomfortable, too. And actually, comedians, even though their work is different than what mine is, they love what I do. Mm-hmm. They love it because they understand that what really goes on is quite a bit different, whether you're looking at Hollywood or sports. I don't care what it is. There's a tremendous gap between what we're told and what's really going on.
Okay, so there's a lot to cover, and obviously we're going to have to have you back on, hopefully.
Absolutely. Glad to do it. Sure.
So what I would like to do is look at a couple of issues that are on the front page right now and then get to a Family of Secrets. Let's talk about Wesley Clark's speech on Who, What, Why. You talk about a speech that General Wesley Clark, who was, I believe, head of NATO.
Correct.
So Wesley Clark, who's hosting a horrific show on NBC, which glorifies war, we won't even talk about that. To me, he's sold out. But you, in whowhatwhy.com, you talk about a speech he gave in 2007 where he says there was a policy coup under the Bush administration to overthrow a series of leaders in the Middle East, right?
Right. Well, what he said, and by the way, I think it's really important that even if you don't appreciate his choices of how he earns a living, I mean, again, I'm trying to be objective about this stuff. People who are in the military, they retire relatively young, and they still have another career ahead of them, and they really pretty much have to go to work for a military contractor or something like that.
They become lobbyists.
Well, they don't really have that many options. I mean, realistically, if they have a certain standard of living and so forth. And so that's what they do. Now, he instead of doing that, he opted to become an entertainment guy, and his thing, they have this silly show where they sort of of, you know, glorify special ops, and it's a kind of a reality thing or something, or a game show. Anyway, never mind. I don't care that much about it in the context of this.
So, in other words, you're saying that he could have been part of the revolving door. And
he opted to do something else, which is all, you know.
More honorable.
It's easy to attack because it's tasteless, but in a way it's more honorable.
It's more honorable than cashing in as...
Than killing people unnecessarily, yeah.
And selling hardware to the Pentagon that they don't need.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, but what I'm interested in is just his speech, because I don't think he was making this up.
We're seeing something under the Obama administration, a wave of overthrows, the Arab Spring, and you're saying this is... that the United States is behind this, or there's a...
Right. So basically, on Who, What, Why, we have done a series of articles. We started with Libya, and now we're doing them about Syria. Bill Moyers, for example, was interviewed and asked about the state of journalism and what does he like. And one of two media outlets that he said he checks regularly that he finds very reliable and gives him important information, we were one of them.
That's fantastic.
Now, the other one was Mother Jones, which has been around forever.
Fantastic. Right.
But we're a little tiny thing. We're a little struggling thing trying to grow. We're a nonprofit, you know, with public support. We're trying to convince people to back us so we can grow this into a large thing. We're very different. I like Mother Jones, but we're very different. We're nonpartisan, and we are trying to appeal to everybody. We want to be like the way that CBS News was when, you know, we were growing up. You'd watch Cronkite, and you'd believe that he didn't have an agenda, and he was trying to figure out what was going on. That's what we want to be at Who, What, Why. So anyway, Bill said that our coverage of Libya was the best and really the only coverage he saw anywhere in the world that it seemed to explain him what was really going on. Now, our analysis, and we don't have the time here to go into that, but I would urge people to go to whowhatwhy.com and just go in. There's a search box. You can just type in Libya, or you'll find some of them on the homepage. We started looking at that with an open mind to figure out what that was, and it eventually dawned on us. And it, again, with time, I can explain the reasons and the fact that sent us in that direction. What happened was that the United States government and its allies decided, looking at those first two Arab Spring uprisings, and decided it's better to join them if you can't beat them, and let's get in and use these things. And so I think they began hijacking, using legitimate grievances of people in Libya and Syria who forever have been wanting to overthrow their governments, and basically to help them do it so that they can throw out governments they don't like and replace them with friendly ones. Now, this is what Wesley Clark himself separately is asserting. He says...
He said this before the Arab Spring.
Right. He said that in 2007. He said that back in a speech which has not been widely disseminated, he said that in 2001, he was at the Pentagon shortly after 9/11, and that they were on the move. They were on the move to do certain things using 9/11 as their justification, and that he was told, first of all, by Rumsfeld directly certain things, but then when he was passing the duty desk of the Joint Chief Staff, one of the staffers who knew him, of course, from his years there, said, pulled him aside and said, I think there's something you should know. And he said, what's that? And he said, we have received a memo. Of course, it's, you know, top secret, but he told him, he said that that the United States government has decided that there are going to be a number of invasions by, I guess, the United States and its allies in some form, that there had been a decision made to remove seven regimes in 5 years. And he lists those regimes, and they've already done four of them. They're on their way to two or three more.
This is the David Feldman Radio Network.
We're back. All right, so we were talking about Wesley Clark, and the regimes that have been overthrown so far are Libya, Egypt, Iraq.
Well, Egypt's not wasn't on the list.
That was not
something they wanted to do. They were perfectly happy to keep Mubarak in power. The ones on the list off the top of my head are, in no particular order, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Iran, Somalia, Sudan, that's six, and I think maybe Lebanon, although I'm not positive about that.
But Lebanon was, I just read the article.
I think it's that's one of those. That they, I guess these were, they were looking at all these places as, either as ones that were very, very iffy and kind of chaotic, or ones where the regimes had always been either very independent of the United States guidance, or hostile to it, in the case of Iran. And so that their sense was, now Clark says that at one point, I guess he asked what was the motivation, and at one point this fellow or one of the people he was talking to said that as he understood it, although it had never been explained, they perceived a window in which the United States could, as the world's sole superpower, move in to evict what they perceived as sort of remaining Soviet client states, old Soviet client states or something that sort of felt like that, and to do it before Russia or China or some other power emerges that could seriously countermand them. And that's what we're seeing.
It's the nature of war is a vacuum theory.
That's right. And that's what we're seeing with Syria right now, because China and Russia are trying to stop this intervention, but their power is, you know, just kind of borderline.
All right. Lebanon has been taken over by Hezbollah, essentially, but it's always been chaos. The Sudan has been split, I believe, between the Christians got the lower part of Sudan and...
It's also mostly about oil, which is principally either in the south or in the,
and Somalia,
in the border region.
I would assume there's oil.
Somalia is very important because of the shipping lanes there, and you know they make a big deal about the pirates and all of that. It's just the horn there, that in Eritrea, have always been crucial strategic locations. Really, you know what it is for bases. I think that's what they want.
I'm just trying to understand. Okay, so I'm just trying to go through this. Somalia, yeah. Bush is the father went into Somalia right before he left office, under humanitarian aid.
I understand they all go in. Obama went into Somalia purportedly to rescue an aid worker. Do you remember that? It was a one of those Navy SEAL things, which they trumpeted.
That first kill.
You know, how exciting it was, terrific it was.
Right.
And as we point out on Who, What, Why, again, worth searching for that article, where we raise doubts about that whole operation. What was the basis for it? Does it fit some kind of standard that they have stated, the criteria for these kinds of things?
When I read your piece about Wesley Clark's speech and this theory, this unified theory to overthrow certain countries, I view Lebanon, Somalia, the Sudan as Hobbesian states that really don't have governments. When they say Somali pirates, I say they're not really pirates. That's the government. The same way the British had pirates that were working for the Queen. These are not real states. They're failed states. Is that a correct assessment?
Yeah, but you have to understand something. Wesley Clark is not a political science genius. I don't really care what his interpretation is. I'm only interested in his claim of a factual series of events, including his talking to this man and this man telling him, we have received a memo that we're looking to go into and target these places. Now, his interpretation of why or speculation doesn't matter that much to me. But my interpretation, based on my reporting over the years, is that the United States is actually a very rational, has very consistent policy, which is most of the foreign policy is designed to protect access to natural mm-hmm. and strategic resources. That's what keeps the light on. That's what keeps this cup of water cool.
Right.
And so that's really the name of the game. When they talk about national interest, but they never specify, what they're doing is they're walking a very difficult line between, hey, folks, so that you can live your life the way you do and have that nice barbecue this weekend, we are going to be going and grabbing stuff imperial style all over the world, which is what everybody does. But we can't say it openly. So we talk about fostering democracy
right.
and so forth. And so in places like Somalia, you're right that they're certainly chaotic entities, but there is a need for bases, and the bases are principally to protect these access to these resources. I have now come to the conclusion, for example, people say, well, that's the U.S. doing the right thing, really supporting these people's aspirations, because Syria doesn't have considerable natural resources. That struck me as first at first as logical until I thought about what's right next door to it, which is Iraq, which has enormous natural resources. What's been happening recently? Obama has basically been compelled or inclined to remove American troops from Iraq. Now you have a problem. There are all these American companies and all the buddies of all these people in the south and in the north up in Kurdistan drilling for oil. And that all those oil fields need to be protected.
Uh-huh.
If you can't have bases in Iraq, which they can't, why not put them next door in the poor country that has no resources? Because then people say, well, you're only in there to help the Syrian people.
Well, that's really interesting. So let's talk about Syria, because that's on the front page, and we're hearing about these massacres. The Alawites are a minority. They're Shiite, and they have the iron fist. They're crushing the Sunnis. You have Assad, who is the son of Assad, and he is running this country. And we all know about his father's massacre, I think in 82, where he killed 30,000. I don't know, where was that?
That was in not Hula. Yes. Look.
So they've learned. So the message from Assad is create a massacre. Kill these people until they...
I'm not sure about that. In fact, we've been looking at the reports of the massacres, and first of all, the son is not the father. The son is Western educated.
He's an
ophthalmologist.
Yeah.
He has tried in his own way to sort of
figure out... How good an eye doctor could he be if he didn't see this coming?
Right. You know, he has been trying to find a way to modernize and still keep his family in power. But, you know, look, I mean, in every country, certain families are always enormously influential, either in power. In the United States, they run giant, corporate empires, and they're very influential by getting their guy to be president. So I think we are a little bit...
Could he be a good guy?
No, but the point I'm making is I don't think that any person running any of those countries, whether the U.S. You think the Saudis are better than him? I mean, demonstrably not. And so that's not the criteria. There's a whole back history. But what is very interesting is the countries are getting rid of, the regimes are getting rid of, which are these kind of quasi-socialistic, Ba'athist, you know, Syria, Iraq, Libya. They actually had higher standards of living. They were more evolved by far in the way they treat women, the way they treat minorities.
You're talking, but now he's not a Ba'athist, is he?
They were. Iraq, I mean, Syria was Ba'athist. Yes, absolutely.
Assad is a Ba'athist.
Listen, you know, I'm not an expert in that area, but
right.
I can tell you this, that Syria and Libya and Iraq were the dominant countries in the Middle East that were not ruled by royalty and that did not allow the mullahs, the religious forces, to dictate daily life.
Right, they had women in the parliament.
Women didn't have to cover themselves.
Right.
People
under
could do
Hussein,
whatever.
In Iraq, they
right.
had women in the parliament.
And in Libya, you know, Gaddafi had all these things where they would give you a home, you know, or a free education. I mean, these all kinds of things like that. So it's complicated. It's all very, very complicated.
I mean, I'm not going to defend Assad.
There's no – my point is
– But let me try to defend him.
Yeah.
Because I do know that recently somebody strapped some plastic to their body and blew up their defense ministry and killed his top generals. And when I hear suicide bombing, I think religious fundamentalists, I think Iraq, I think huge problems. I think, you know, once you're dealing with suicide bombers, it's a whole other game that you cannot win. It'll go on and on and on. So when I heard about the suicide bombing, I thought, well, maybe Assad isn't so bad. Maybe he maybe his head hits the pillow and he's able to sleep at night because he does math. And he says, you know, like Tom Hanks in Private Ryan, X number of people die. I've saved X number of people. So there's a part of me that thinks Assad is calculating that if 30,000 people die here, I've saved 100,000 lives, which is what Tom Hanks pretty much said in Saving Private Ryan, that I have to massacre That's the math of the Middle East. You kill 20,000 to save 150,000. So is it possible that he is not that horrible guy that our government is portraying, that he understands that neighborhood a lot better than we do?
I think the problem is that we just don't have any consistent standard at looking at these people. And an example would be that there's been an uprising going on in Saudi Arabia where people have been trying to have freedom, and they have been attacked by the police and the military. Some people have been killed, not that many, because it's not necessary yet to do that. But the United States hasn't said a word about that. The U.S. was not interested in the uprising in Egypt because Mubarak was their guy. Mubarak was also secular, but at the same time, the kleptocracy, the amount of money that was stolen, and the poverty of the people was much worse in Egypt than it was in Syria, or than it was in Libya, or than it was in Iraq. So our whole conversation is not, in the United States, is not very good. It's not very elevated. It's not very consistent.
How powerful is the United States? How much change can we affect in the Middle East? I do know that we can, if I were president, I could, and you were Assad or Saddam Hussein, I could say, I can turn your lights off. I have the air power to destroy your country and just keep bombing you into a coup, which is what Clinton did in Serbia with Milosevic. That to me was the perfect exercise, and I'm speaking out of ignorance, but it was the perfect exercise of American power. We're not going to really send ground troops into Belgrade, but we'll just turn off your lights, turn off your power, and if you're a rational human being, which Milosevic sort of was, he left. And I think that's all we can do, is just keep bombing you from above until your generals say, we're taking over. Isn't that all the power we really have?
No, because the United States has a massive covert activity operation that is always in the picture. There always are operatives. And this is another thing I write about. And Family of Secrets, by the way, what it is principally is a history of this whole, you know, kind
CIA.
Of underground. It's much more than CIA. CIA, NSA, DIA, on and on and on. And there are so, you know, there are so many thousands and thousands and thousands of people who that's all they do, is they go into these other countries undercover, or they recruit local people. We are always, and we're not the only ones, the whole world is like that. There's French, there's British people, the intelligent people everywhere trying to get information, trying to gain an advantage. So I think, and when you ask, is the United States powerful? Clearly it is powerful. It's becoming less powerful as we squander our resources on war. Eventually we will become less powerful. And so it becomes a kind of a self-fulfilling thing that, you know, Sparta cannot endure endlessly.
Now, I think in your book you say that it's in the best interest of the powers that be to be in a perpetual state of war.
It is for them, but it's also in a short-sighted kind of way. In other words, it's also in their interest to deny climate change. In the long run, we all fry, but they don't think that way. So in the short run, all these things are in their interest.
It's just war is good for business. War.
You have to understand something. These people are not that sophisticated.
Right.
If you sit down, a lot of very, very wealthy people are not even that smart.
Right.
You know, they're really not. They lucked out. Their great-grandfather was a cattle rustler or something, and
right.
They have all this money, and they've got all these lawyers and stuff who are smart, but they themselves are not particular geniuses.
And the lawyers aren't that smart.
Not necessarily.
Just,
they play rough or whatever, you know, yeah.
I mean, Clint Eastwood speaking at the Republican convention, to me, shows you just how ignorant the wealthy are.
It's the dumb leading the dumb, you know, and the ironic thing is, and I'm going to go even further. Let me throw this shocker out here. We can continue this, I hope, in a subsequent discussion. I am increasingly mortified by the liberals. And what I mean by that is this. Coming here to LA and visiting, and I'm from here originally, and hanging out with from time to time with affluent liberals, Hollywood liberals, and so on. I'm sort of surprised at how little really they understand about stuff, and our system is not necessarily run by the smartest people. Our TV shows that we watch are not necessarily populated by or written by people we should be looking to for wisdom. Yet we do. And people, when I say things to people, they say, well, I haven't heard of you. Maybe I haven't read your book. And they say, well, I know because I watch, you know, XYZ show. So I know what's going on. Well, think about that rationally. Why do you assume that you're getting the correct information from those shows? Those are the shows that have the resources to bring their stuff to you. But what interests me is that a lot of the people I meet who are the smartest are sort of these oddball people. We might not invite them over to our dinner party or something because, you know, they got an egg stain on their shirt. They don't have the best hygiene or whatever. But these are people who are real individualists and real free thinkers. I mean, I sort of think of KPFK a little bit that way, that it's kind of a lot of people who are they're originals, you know, and they're always thinking and they're
well, because I wrestle with this, the individual versus the team player. And I wear two hats as a stand-up comic. It's me, myself, and I. But then I got to go make money. And I become the team player who isn't a threat to the system or his boss and goes along, gets along. And as I'm sitting at tables, at writing tables, I understand the Wannasey convention, which was how they came up with the final solution. You sit at a table and it's getting late and somebody has an idea and you want to go home. And next thing you know, you're pounding the table and say, yeah, round them up and exterminate them. And I see how groupthink works. One of the things, though, that lone wolves don't understand, that team players do, and sometimes I'm a team player, I understand that everybody hates each other on a team. So it makes me very dubious when it comes to conspiracies. I don't think conspiracies can exist because there is so much internecine competition and backstabbing mm-hmm. that eventually somebody talks.
You know, I love to talk about that subject because, as you know, Family of Secrets
right.
has a lot of people conspiring to do things.
Right.
And I will tell you this, conspiracies are normal and they are the everyday state of affairs. Conspiracies exist in all forms everywhere. In courtrooms throughout the land,
right.
on Tuesday, prosecutors will stand up
right.
to argue a case of conspiracy. Conspiracy is when people who may...
You and I are conspiring right now to make a radio show.
Well, I don't want to use the term too broadly,
but I'm
talking about people who are doing the crime of conspiracy, which is instead of acting alone to commit a crime, you get together with other people to commit a crime. It usually can only work when there is some agreed upon secrecy involved. Now, in this country, millions and millions of people, usually at a fairly young age, are approached by other people and offered the chance to join a secret society. Okay, and millions of Americans are members of secret society. When you ask them, they won't talk.
I happen to be a member of KPFK, which is a secret society.
Unfortunately. They're trying to do something about that, by the way.
The David Feldman Comedy Podcast is made possible by listeners like you. For the price of a magazine or a sandwich, you can support this original and daring program and help us grow by making a safe and secure donation via PayPal. Please go to DavidFeldmanComedy.com to make a one-time or a monthly donation. Or if you can't do that, be a friend by telling all your friends about this wonderful show. Thank you for listening.
Okay, so I was saying that the competitive nature of humanity dictates that within an organization, there will be checks and balances. Even something as big as this, the CIA would have opposing forces within it that would provide checks and balances.
It doesn't work that way because the things are designed, first of all, on the basis of a kind of a cellular nature. They're also created on the basis of plausible deniability and of need to know. And so even when you're inside those things, you often know less about what's really going on than people who aren't inside. And you're so focused on your particular thing,
mm-hmm.
you're often told false stories about why you are being sent to do things by people who themselves may not even know that the story is false. The inherent nature in the psychology of secret organizations is extremely elaborate, and a huge amount of thinking has gone into precisely that. How do you prevent the conspiracies or the secrets from being revealed? That's a lifetime passion for these people. And so you and I, who don't think that way and who, you know, dine out on the gossip that we can, we can dish, these people are not interested in that. They deliberately join secret societies because they want to feel special, and they want to feel that they are in an elite club. So what they do is, when you're in those kinds of things, the E. Howard Hunts and so on would get together with five or six people like themselves and with their cocktails and so on, and up to a point tell each other what they know. But that's good enough for them. They're never going to tell that to anybody else.
I was reading in Rolling Stone Matt Taibbi, and he quoted, I think it's Cerebus, the hedge fund manager, who said, if someone who works for Cerebus gets his name in the paper, I'll kill him. Now, he was joking around, but he says not, but he didn't back down. He says, I'll kill him. Your job is to make billions for Cerebus, which is a hedge fund or a venture capital firm, and you do not get your name in the paper.
And by the way, I mean, I talk to people all the time. You know people like that who are close-lipped about everything. They even if you've known them all your life, they won't really tell you anything about what's going on in their family dynamics. People are different. And those agencies look for people who are not blabbermouths and people who like secrets, who keep secrets and are inclined to hold their cards close anyway. Those are the people that they want in there.
And they all come from Yale. And,
Yale has all types, but they're in there very avidly looking for people. You know, they do those psychological tests. They're looking for people with certain characteristics. And then on top of that, they sign all kinds of agreements where they are basically told, if you talk about any of this stuff, you could go to jail for a long time. I think that's what the Bradley Manning thing is about, is that that is a message to people. And that's why, because there's no reason to put him in solitary confinement. There's no reason, except if it's not scary enough that he's been arrested and people don't pay attention, the idea that you could end up in solitary is so scary that people think even about being a whistleblower at a low level in the EPA. They don't want to do it. And mm-hmm. So I believe, because I have seen evidence and I've collected it over the years as a journalist, that organized crime is a conspiracy, and people from organized crime don't sing. That's why there are all these elaborate things where the FBI or whatever are always looking for somebody to turn them, and then they've got to move them and their entire family, put them in the witness protection program. I mean, what I'm trying to say is there are strong disincentives for talking, and these make it difficult. That plus the compartmentalization and all the lies told to the participants make it difficult to unravel ever things like these presidential assassinations and so forth, because they're designed to be like that.
So let's try to tie it into what's going on right now, or what we think is going on right now. We're not prosecuting torture. We killed a guy in Abu Ghraib, and we thought there was going to be some prosecution of the guys behind that. There's no prosecution of torture in this country, but we're going after the whistleblowers. Who is more dangerous? The people from Blackwater who do the torturing, the private security guards who are, I guess now they're out of Bahrain. Where did Prince move, the head of XE, which used to be Blackwater?
Oh, he relocated to...
He went somewhere, I think.
To the Middle East, too.
Not Qatar.
I think it's not Qatar. It's the Emirates. Anyway, it's...
Yeah, the UAE.
I think it's the UAE.
The UAE.
Yeah.
Are they... These are the private security firms, the privatization of our military. That's more dangerous than the Pentagon.
But
right?
You see, that's looking at it backwards, because I would argue that the government itself is an instrumentality of these private elements.
Right.
And
right.
So when we say Blackwater is out of control. No. Blackwater is a direct manifestation of what the same people try to affect within the government.
I mean, Blackwater didn't exist during the Kennedy assassination.
Well, but you see, here's another thing. There have always been...
But he was killed essentially by, I think, somebody like Blackwater, right?
I wouldn't say that. I'm continuing my research in that area. But I think that even the evidence that's in Family of Secrets, and there are four chapters just on the Kennedy assassination, that, and people would say, well, that's a book about the Bush family and their influence and where they came from and what was really going on. Actually, what it is a series of endless revelations from my research, one of which is in relation to my discovering that George H.W. Bush claimed he couldn't remember where he was when Kennedy was shot in November 1963. And I became so interested in that, and I thought, well, let me just find out where he was. And that led me into years of research on both him and the Kennedy assassination. And so these chapters are all really – they're a microcosm of the Kennedy assassination related to the Bush family circle. And when you see that and you learn that George H.W. Bush was in CIA, not just in 1976 as the outsider who was appointed director purportedly, but that he was actually an insider, that he'd been in CIA all those years, that he was in CIA in 1963
Yale,
in Texas,
Skull and Bones,
when he couldn't remember where he was. And so then you begin to see that, no, that's not Blackwater. That's Yale. That's Banks. That's giant General Dynamics that have contracts at stake, and there are huge investigations of graft and fraud, and people are going to go to jail unless prosecutions are stopped.
But wasn't he living in Texas at the time?
He was a Texan, that's right.
Midland? I mean, so...
He was living in Houston, but he was a candidate for the U.S. Senate and was on the road in Dallas and other places at the time campaigning against Kennedy. So, of course, that's a tantalizing thing about where was he and why did he claim he didn't remember? And the answer takes us down this rabbit's hole, but it begins to expose me personally, and then I think to other people who didn't have a dog in that fight. What I want to emphasize, I think this is important, is that I am not a person who carries very strong theories and certainties about why particular things happen and who did it or something like that. I'm not that kind of person. I'm very much of a serious investigative reporter where I go into every story fresh again with the idea. So, for example, I won't buy it that because I heard that George Bush is dumb that he's actually necessarily dumb. I want to see the evidence.
And now, Richard Nixon was in Dallas the day before.
He was there that day, actually, and he lied about it. He actually lied about it to the FBI. He said he had left several days before, but he didn't. He left several hours before.
Could an argument be made that there's the Academy Awards? You suddenly find, oh my God, Steven Spielberg and Jeffrey Katzenberg are in the same room. Is there a conspiracy? Why were they all? Well, it was the Academy Awards. How big an event was John Kennedy coming to Dallas? I would think, and I do believe there's a conspiracy, by the way, I'm just playing devil's advocate here. Could an argument be made that Kennedy coming to Dallas was a big thing and that a lot of people showed up for it because it was kind of like a convention of opportunists?
No, it actually was not a big thing. It was only a big thing in the sense that certain people who I believe were setting up the scenario. This is, again, a classic intel thing that people like Howard Hunt and David Atlee Phillips, they had done the same thing.
Who's David Atlee Phillips?
Oh, these are top CIA operatives. They had done the same things in Guatemala and in Iran and in later, in Chile and so on. This is what they do. They go and they lay the groundwork. And so the whole idea is that PSYOPs, it's all what the public thinks. PSYOPs plays an enormous role in everything.
What is PSYOP?
It's psychological operations. It's directly related to advertising and public relations, which are how do you manipulate people to perceive things in a way that is favorable to you. And that's what politics is. That's what entertainment is. That's what almost everything is. You're channeling people toward a desired result. And so in Dallas, there were a number of factions and things going on, but there were desired results. One of them was that the people should conclude that Kennedy was actually in a place where there were lots of people who hated him, that it was a dangerous milieu just in general. This is part of this thing of presidents. In the history of the United States, many presidents have been shot or there have been attempted shootings, dozens and dozens of them, as recently as a man shooting into the Obama White House, several shootings at Gerald Ford, et cetera, et cetera. People don't know how many of these there are. And we are told that all of them all of them, 100%, were by crazy people. Now, given the fact that the United States itself sponsors non-crazy people doing the exact same thing to remove or kill leaders elsewhere, how logical is that? Statistically, it's a total impossibility. Right. It doesn't make any sense. And so, as a serious thinking person, you have to be open to the idea that somebody is deliberately misleading you into thinking that 100% of these things are nuts or loners. Now, as far as Dallas goes, they were creating a milieu with that ad, that big black bordered ad in the Dallas Morning News that morning that was kind of a threat to Kennedy. And it had a bunch of signed names on there, a bunch of Jewish names, which was crazy because, of course, Jews didn't hate Kennedy. But by the people who actually were behind the ad were people who thought, you know, well, let's blame it on the Jews, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is all psyops.
Well, he did get shot in the temple. That's an old joke I think, about Lincoln getting shot in the temple. Yeah. Anyway, I was just going for a joke.
Yeah, well, why not?
The Kennedy assassin, everybody was there. I mean, everybody who went, like Dan Rather went on to become an anchorman. Robert McNeil was there. He became an anchorman. I think Peter Jennings might have been. Everybody became like a top reporter in the next 10 years was there at the assassination.
Which raises an interesting question. Why is that?
Because they didn't question it.
Okay. Now, that's very interesting. Some people would say it's just that because it became such a big historical event, if you could say you were there working at the time, that then, your star had that extra luster on it. That's one possible argument. Another one is that all those people went along to some extent. And I have to say, Dan is somebody I've gotten to know. There's a blurb on the back of Family Secrets. He says he loves it. He and I have had conversations about what happened in Dallas. But, you know, you cannot be an anchorman for a giant corporation like CBS or NBC or something unless you understand what you can and cannot do. And it doesn't make them out to be bad people, but that's the matrix, basically. And so that's why when a Walter Cronkite leaves and then, you know, at first he used to dismiss anybody who would talk about these things as nuts. And then after he'd been out a certain number of years, he started getting madder and madder. And then he began joining them. By the end of his life, he was, I'm sure he'd been on KPFK. You know, he completely moved over. Dan is liberated to some extent now within.
Dan Rather always looked, because he was there in Dallas, mm-hmm. He always looked like he had stared into the abyss, saw the truth about the United States, and decided I'm going to make a living, and could not get that crazed look out of his eyes. So you always knew there was something simmering underneath Dan. I want to tie it into the tidal wave, the tsunami of lies that are coming out of the Republican convention. I mean, it's Ryan is just a liar. His speech was just fraught with one lie after another, as, you know, Romney. With the Kennedy assassination, it became axiomatic that there was a conspiracy, that the Warren Commission was a punchline. There was a House Assassinations Committee in the late 70s that pretty much said there was a conspiracy, but we don't know who was behind it, probably the mafia. Then all of a sudden, you have Gerald Posner and an ABC documentary that Peter Jennings did, which shows that Oswald acted alone. And I'm going to tie this into Ryan because it's a news dump. That if you wonder how Ryan and Romney can get away with all these lies, I'm trying to make a point here. It seems to me that the Warren Commission, the single bullet, has more credibility now than it did 30 years ago. Is that a fair statement?
I think it does with the intelligentsia. I don't think it does with ordinary people. But my point is that ordinary people in this country are utterly powerless.
Okay, here's the point I'm trying to make. Because people are saying, how does Romney get away with all these lies?
Yeah.
Whereas Nixon, supposedly, and I think you're going to disabuse me of this, but what we're told is that it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. And that the mistake Nixon made was that he hid what happened. I know you disagree with that. But he had to leave because he lied. And the new paradigm is you lie, but you just dump so many lies that the intelligentsia cannot process them. George W. Bush got reelected because there was just this mudslide of lies and crimes that nobody could process it, and they just washed their hands of it. I think that's what the Republicans have learned, is just keep it coming. Mm. That's what I think why the media and the intelligentsia is on the Oswald acted alone page, because there's just, they can't process.
Right. It's too much. It's too much. Look, I want to be clear about this. I do radio, I do TV, and I do public appearances, and particularly in the public appearances where we do long Q&As and there's a lot of interaction. You know, people are very, very interested in these things, but they say to me, my God, you have so much new information that I can't process it. Family of Secrets is, I tell people, it could almost cause you brain damage to read it, because you just mentioned Nixon. I started looking into Watergate, which, again, I had no dog in that fight, but there was George H.W. Bush and the CIA again, and the same people who were at Bay of Pigs, the same people who were involved with the Kennedy thing are showing up again, but they're showing up against Nixon, or not against Nixon, but in some complicated milieu. And I start looking into that, and I spend several years looking at that. And to my mortification, growing up as somebody who just thought Richard Nixon was evil and that it was a triumph of democracy that he was kicked out, I discovered that there's an entirely different story there, which actually makes much more sense and is more consistent with everything else, which is when presidents don't play ball or they stop playing ball, bad things happen to them.
Talking with Russ Baker, author Family of Secrets, and his website is whowhatwhy.com. And we'll be right back.
The David Feldman radio program is made possible by listeners like you. You sad, pathetic humps.
We're talking with Russ Baker. He's the author of Family of Secrets, which chronicles American history, the past 50 years, and how the Bush family has played a major role in how we live now. He's also running a website that's really great, and you should check it out, whowhatwhy.com. Are you drawing conclusions? Because I haven't finished Family of Secrets. Do you draw conclusions? Do you have... Or are you just reporting?
Oh, no. I mean, there are lots of conclusions in there. They're presented subtly in somewhat nuanced fashion. And, for example, one of the things that's widely quoted at the end of the book, I say, I had no idea. As a journalist of 25 years, I didn't really understand how things work. Most journalists have no idea how things work because they're so busy with their nose to the grindstone, covering every minute of the convention and so forth. They don't have the luxury to read books.
You say we need to study the institutions, not the people.
Yeah.
Which goes counter to everything I believe. It really does. I always say it's not the institutions, it's the people. It's not...
Well, let's take BP, okay? So Tony Hayward, who was the guy who, in order to please his bosses, pressed these people to abandon all the safety measures, and then eventually they tossed him overboard.
And he got his life back.
And now they have a piece in the Times about how he's starting over again. But he's expendable. Do you understand? The beast is bigger than any person. Now, look, it's not that I don't study the people. Family of Secrets, if there's a complaint people have, there are too many characters in here. I follow every one of these people. I want to know who McCord is, really. I want to know, really, what was the story with Spiro Agnew? Why did Nixon take Agnew, and then why was Agnew thrown overboard? What's the real stories? Because if you study, it's a huge amount of work. That's why most journalists can't or won't do it. I spend years and years and years, and people who know me say, my God, what you do. I look at the books you're reading. You got 20 books open at the same time. You got thousands of documents. You're interviewing hundreds of people. It's a lot of work. That's why I started Who, What, Why, because the only way we're going to save the world is to do a much, much more muscular form of journalism. And the only way we're going to do that is to get out from under the yoke of the corporations and fund it through the public.
The beasts, the institutions, there are people behind these beasts.
Yeah, and they die and other people come in and, you know, people retire and so on, but the things continue.
Okay, so I have a theory that Donald Trump is broke. Because anybody who, if he were truly a billionaire, he would not be doing what he's doing.
Right. Well, Trump's thing has always been to use other people's money to create a kind of a glitz, and they go to people who are wannabes, you know, a new billionaire from Uruguay or somewhere who thinks it's glamorous to live in the penthouse of Trump Towers and to say that he's Trump's business partner.
So he's like the Dapper Don. I never felt gaudy. I am led to believe by the Democrats that the Koch brothers are pulling the strings for the Republican Party, that they control Scalia, they control Clarence Thomas, and they kind of explain to me what the Republicans want, which is don't pay taxes, protect coal, protect oil, deny global warming because the Koch brothers will lose money. Are the Koch brothers a front, or are they running the beast?
It goes back to what I said earlier about Cheney, Sarah Palin, Condi. We talked about Condi at the beginning. These are hired hands. Now, I'm not saying the Koch brothers are hired hands because they can hire the hands, but throughout history, there have been wealthy people. Then you get an Adelson. Okay, so these people come and go, but they can only.
Well, Adelson is just trying to stay out of prison, right?
Well, listen, all of these people probably, in my opinion, could be prosecuted and go to prison.
But I often feel that Adelson.
But you think the Koch brothers are implicated in bribery in France? You know, I mean, they've done things in this country that clearly were violations of the law. So
Adelson's a minor player, though, right?
Look, I don't know, but because I haven't studied him very carefully. But my point is that these people, if you've got money, you can play. And it is a mistake for us to – you see, that's what those shows like on MSNBC and Comedy Central, they need characters that they can ridicule. And so an undue amount of our energy goes to focus on sort of transitory figures that pass through that are real and that for whatever reason do what they do, but they are not representative of the greater totality. And my point is, you know, they could slip on a banana peel tomorrow and all the stuff you're talking about coal and oil and deny global warming would all continue because there's a whole system that we all suckle at its teat that requires this kind of denial.
We're talking with Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets. Go to whowhatwhy.com. You were saying Bill Moyers goes there.
Well, that's what he says. He says he goes there daily. Our frustration, and I just want to be clear about this, is we're tiny because we can only grow with public support. And when we have people say, why don't you cover this? Well, you should cover that. And so I say, listen, we're a little tiny thing. We want to grow and we want to become your trusted source for news on a daily and even hourly basis.
So Obama, we'll wrap it up with our president. I love him. I think that he has straddled so many areas of the world and parts of his family that he thinks in his heart that he can straddle good and evil, that he can go to the Oval Office, make deals with whatever nefarious forces are controlling us, and still come out good because that's the way he lived his life, that he had to deal with all the bad hands that were dealt to him and somehow keep his head above the clouds. So I do think he's a good guy. I also, in my darkest moments, think that he really does have a mysterious background.
He certainly does. I mean, there are lots, you know, look, people say to me, well, you did this amazing eye-opening thing about the Bushes. Why don't you do it about Obama? And I wish I could. Again, it's a matter of the fact
time.
My goal, honestly, is to train a whole new generation of investigative reporters and have a lot of people.
And you do teach. You've taught at the Columbia Journalism School.
I have. And that's what I want to do. I want to find a way to fund. That's why I'm out in L.A. is to try to find people who can help us make this thing happen.
And without drawing conclusions. In other words, you could just – just put facts into the universe.
Right.
The role of a journalist is to put facts into the universe.
Yeah, like, let's take Obama. So, for example, I think it's possible he was born abroad. I don't know. But, you know, people get so angry one way or the other, and it just seems totally irrational to me. Why, anything's possible.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, Romney's father was, I think, was born in
Mexico.
And he was able to run for president. You know, he was a presidential candidate.
Listen, I maintain that Romney must be Mexican because Mexicans take work away from hardworking Americans, and that's what Mitt Romney does. Okay, just want to throw a little joke in there.
Yeah, good, good.
Yeah, Romney was born. I mean, they are almost Manchurian.
Did you see this thing about how there's an early book proposal that Obama's publisher sent out? They're flogging his first or one of his first books, and it says on there, Barack Obama was born in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did he not look at it before they sent it out? Did they make a mistake? Did he know he wasn't born in Kenya but thought that that made him seem more
interesting? Like Elizabeth Warren claiming to be an Indian.
Yes. My point is things are complicated. There are nuances. And you need to do incredible due diligence to get to the bottom of these things. And then when you do, then you can say, look, should the U.S. restrict the presidency to people who were born here? What if they were born in a plane 10 minutes from landing here? You know, I mean, where do you draw the line and what are our priorities? So what I'm about and what Who, What, Why is about trying to kind of – you know, pump some air in the room, you know, kind of open things up a little bit and get away from this sort of ad hominem. You see, the left-right thing doesn't appeal to me either because even though I may sympathize more with one than the other, I think it's largely a kind of a fiction which is designed to keep the masses sort of at each other's throats while the, you know, the Henry Kissinger and all their buddies kind of get away with murder, basically. All those hot-button issues, whatever the thing we're all mad at each other on, it's always the same people who aren't paying any taxes and whatever who are getting away with it. And so that's my interest, really, is that kind of stuff.
So Obama, I do at night like to think of him as riding herd on evil. And he's just – he knows it's evil. He knows who the bad guys are, and he's just trying to rein it all in, although he certainly has surrounded himself with bad guys, including Eric Holder. You know,
they're almost all bad. Look, you know, the financial people, the military
Geithner,
people, the you know, I on Who, What, Why, we write a lot about people who don't get any attention. One of his closest friends, Robert Wolf of UBS, the leading bank in terms of basically stealing money from the U.S. Treasury by helping rich
Swiss?
Americans. Yes, but he's the head of their North American operations, helping people that, you know, we actually list all the things they did. They would give people shredders and untraceable cell phones. I mean, it's a crime. It's a giant crime syndicate. This is the guy that he would go to Martha's Vineyard with and would be – he'd round out his golfing foursome. So, you know, the guy raised money from – he's probably a nice guy personally. If you and I met him, we'd probably like to go out for lox and bagels with him, you know. But he's fronting this – horrible entity in this part of this process. And Obama probably says, you know what, I don't care. The guy raises money for me personally. He's sort of liberal, probably, you know what I mean? And this is how it works.
So they would be separate from the people behind Romney, or it's the same people?
You know, it's not that different. I mean, I just read a thing that one of the Ron Paul people, there's a blog and he's writing about the convention, and you know the Ron people walked out and so on. And he said, look, let's look at what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a liberal Republican from Massachusetts running against a conservative Democrat. I thought that was actually pretty close. I don't really believe that there is a huge difference personally between those two men. I think that they're both ambitious, practical guys who kind of do whatever it takes to get ahead. Obama's mission is to keep the center while winking to his base, which are the shock troops, which are the liberals, and Romney's is to do the opposite, is to openly sort of embrace this rightist thing while kind of hinting that he's really not that crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is he doesn't have any deep-seated beliefs other than he's just looking for some. He's a rich boy looking for the next thing to do. What else is there to do? And there's the presidency. As far as Obama, you know, when he was in college, he didn't really express that many views. I don't know if you've seen this, but I remember an early New York Times profile, and they interviewed his friends. they'd be sitting around drinking or, you know, smoking dope or whatever they were doing, and everybody be, you know, ranting about things. And he was very careful not to state his views. And I think that was because he was so ambitious. He already wanted to be president back then, and he thought, I'm not going to do anything that gets me in trouble. Now, I don't really love that, but I understand how that's, you know, helps you be successful. So I don't care what kind of guy he is. And I don't, you know, I think that we spend too much time worrying about whether he's a nice guy or not, because I'm not interested in him at all. I'm only interested in what is causing the United States to continue to launch imperial wars. What is continuing to allow an oligarchy to basically shape this country's trajectory.
Right.
That's what interests me.
Right. That is, and that's a great way to leave it on, because I'm a team player sometimes. I identify myself first and foremost as a Democrat, dyed-in-the-wool liberal, progressive, and I agree with you that, well, argue with Republicans. When I say they, they'll go, who's they, you paranoid, delusional, schizophrenic? I say the people with money. And if you're looking for a grand conspiracy, if you're looking for a unified theory of what makes everything happen, it's money. I want money. You want money. Somebody's taking away my money and power. Then I make decisions accordingly. So that the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, Iraq, the Arab Spring.
By the way, there's a third thing which is very important, and that is self-perception. And this is ego and revenge and embarrassment and all of these things. And that has to be brought into that equation, because this goes a long way. When people say things like, well, who's they? The person who's saying that doesn't want to go further in exploring things. And it's easier to kind of get on the offensive and disarm you, or use terms like conspiracy theory or whatever to sort of say, you know, anybody who proposes that we look at things in a more substantive way should be just rejected out of hand.
Well, you should definitely read Family of Secrets, written by Russ Baker. I'm reading it. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you I've gotten past the first three chapters, but I'm going to plow through it. It's fascinating. And you're also a great writer, by the way. The sentences move. And whowhatwhy.com is also a great website that you should check out. And I hope I'll be able to contact you via Skype.
I think you will.
Thank you, Russ.
Thank you.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. Hey, if you're this deep into it, if you stayed with us all the way to the bitter end, please do me a favor and go to iTunes and give us a nice review. Thank you.
Standing on the corner, simple as it may seem. Standing on the corner. Lord, I don't know just where I stand. I don't know just where I stand. So I gotta say sometimes, oh, I would rather be white and live in a shack than live in a palace and be called a cockney black. Got to say sometimes, oh, I would rather be white, ooh, baby, and live in a shack. Streets all. Hey! I want to thank you all.